Episode 159, 2001, A Space Odyssey Review.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing theology at warp speed. I'm Ben Anderson.
I am Ben DiBono. And we are back, having just witnessed 20 minutes of monkeys, plus another movie afterwards.
Yeah, that's actually true.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it does all tie together.
But it does, yeah.
I'm disappointed.
I'm not. I loved it.
Disappointed. I'm going to go find that clip while you talk.
Disappointed. I didn't know we had a clip for that.
You just go ahead.
Okay.
So, what do you think?
I loved it. I thought it was a brilliant move. Another home run by Stanley Kubrick.
Well,
not that I've seen a lot of his movies, but everything I've seen, I've enjoyed.
Wait a minute. This isn't my world. Disappointed!
Do you know what that is?
No.
Really? Okay. I'll talk about it off the air.
Is that something inappropriate?
No. Well, it's kind of funny.
That should clue us all in.
That's just kind of funny. So, in the Kevin Sorbo series, Hercules,
oh, yeah,
there was a scene where there was a parallel reality evil Hercules that came to our, or not to our, but to the regular Hercules world.
Yeah.
And the script called for him to look around and act disappointed that he was now in a different world. Maybe to say, this isn't my world, and be disappointed about it. But the actor actually just yells out disappointed instead of taking it as a cue, and they kept it in the actual show.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so now with that background, listen again. Evil Hercules with a goatee looking around.
Yes.
Wait a minute. This isn't my world. Disappointed!
That's awesome.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's how I feel. I feel disappointed.
Those were not well-done movies or shows back in the day.
Were they done better than 2001, A Space Odyssey?
I would say no.
I predicted that this would be a 2.
Yeah.
And my final rating was a 2.5.
So you're not disappointed.
Yeah, you're right. I guess it was. But
it's better than you thought it was going to be.
I still feel disappointed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, what did you think it was going to be?
A 5.
And you?
I gave it a 5.
I feel like you just think it has to be a 5.
No, it was a great movie.
I don't know.
I love you Arthur C. Clarke. I love Stanley Kubrick.
You can't actually think that was good.
That was great. I mean, I
read our blog. We were making fun of it the whole time.
Okay, should I read a couple?
So we did a live blog just like we did for Lord of the Rings. And yes. So Ben basically time coded all of our comments.
Yeah, so you can read the blog as you watch the movie.
At thescifarchristian.com.
Exactly. So 9 minutes, 30 seconds in, we're watching the monkeys and I remark to Matt, as we're trying to make sense of what's going on, oh, they're forming a society. And then you say, what about screaming to society to you? And I say, they're gathering together. They're just by the water hole. Everyone goes to the water hole. Which I think is a fair point, Matt.
Yeah, thank you.
You compared it to Fantasia at one point.
Well, there's just nonstop random scenes with classical music.
Well, this is true. This is true.
There is so much randomness.
I mean, I don't think it was actually random. Yeah, the end was pretty trippy.
This is going to be all spoilers.
Yeah, definitely. Well, do we have to give spoiler warnings for a movie that's been out for 50 years?
We have a 10-year rule.
Okay, so yeah, then you're screwed if you haven't seen this. Though, of course, we didn't see it till today.
Yeah.
But, like, I knew most of the spoilers in the movie. Like, I knew that Hal was bad.
It did feel like there were different chapters that made up one full book or movie.
Oh, here was my favorite comment of yours. We're at 1:28, hour and 28 minutes when we hit the intermission. You say, at this point, if I was in the theater, I might think, I'm good.
And just leave? Yeah.
Just leave, yeah.
At the intermission, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So, man, I don't really know a good organization to talk about this movie, but so let's just talk. I did quickly get some notes on the chapters in this movie.
Yeah.
And speaking of chapters, we know that there's a book, and the book and the screenplay were being written simultaneously by Arthur C. Clarke, correct?
I don't know if he wrote the screenplay. I think
he helped to write it, I believe.
Okay.
So, I don't know, Ben. Let's just start at the dawn of man, which is the 20 minutes of monkeys.
Yeah.
Okay, so what did you take away from this?
Well, obviously it's not the most exciting part of the movie, but I was prepared for it going in. So I mean, I thought it was kind of interesting. It's more interesting to me now that I've seen the entire movie and can tie things together with the monolith and all that. So I think that I will enjoy that part more the second time. First time, yeah, it's boring, but I mean, it's well photographed and interesting as far as monkeys go.
I think it was, I mentioned in the video review that we've done for this, if you want to check that out, you can also check that out on YouTube, that I liked it when the monkeys realized that they could use bones as tools or weapons. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then when that monolith appeared, that was interesting. Like, what is this about? And then they just cut to the future. So I'm like, okay, well, that's weird. So that's and it's called the Dawn of Man because I think we're left to believe that their encounter with the monolith leads into the next stage of evolution.
Yes, that was my takeaway.
Okay, I didn't get that myself. I'll have to give credit to Ben on that one.
What did you take away from the monkey part? Like, besides the water?
That aliens have been around since that. Like, maybe they helped create humans.
Well, so we basically had the same idea then.
And that they have all these different monoliths that they put all over the place for who knows what reason.
Including some that are just in orbit around Jupiter.
Next chapter, let's just call it TMA-1, which is the Pan Am space plane.
Oh, yeah.
So we meet Haywood Floyd, who I thought was a pretty good guy.
Yeah, he didn't stick around very long.
No, I thought he'd be a main character, maybe.
So did I.
Like, maybe the lead guy. But he's going to some base called Clavius.
Now, you thought there was a mistake in the movie at this point, because the pen is floating around.
Oh, yeah.
But Floyd is not. Well, guess what, Matt?
He had the seatbelt on.
Yeah, and grip shoes.
And there were some people wearing grip shoes. Which,
you were not impressed by the grip shoes.
No, if you watch them walk in this movie with grip shoes, it's like the least efficient way to move ever. They're walking.
That's true. I would just kind of swim through space, I think might be more efficient. But
all right, so Dr. Floyd here, he is a, I don't even know what kind of doctor he is, but there's some sort of conspiracy happening. They found something on the moon.
Yeah.
And it's another monolith. And so him and another group of people go to the ground floor of the moon.
Yeah.
Go check out this monolith. It starts making sounds, and then they start holding their hands to their ears.
Well, first they pose for the photo op.
Oh, that was awesome.
That was pretty awesome.
And
like, get a picture.
Yeah. And then we don't know what happens. Something bad happens, but they just cut that scene and jump 18 months in the future, and now we're on to the next section.
Well, we know what the sound was, though.
The same sound that came out when the monkey.
No, because we hear the music, but I think that's just for us. But then it makes the screeching sound.
So what is that sound?
That's the signal to Jupiter.
But why? Why are they sending a signal to Jupiter? We still don't know, even having seen the movie.
Well, that's where the aliens or whoever created the monolith wanted humanity to get to.
Is it a signal to Jupiter, or is it a signal from Jupiter?
I think it was a signal to Jupiter. It was signaling Jupiter is what they is
saying.
What
the, they're probably going to come now soon.
Maybe.
I think it's a signal from Jupiter saying,
that's not what
I
said
here
in the video.
What video?
Remember after Dave kills Hal and there's a little video of the guy who's like, here's the secret video we should have told you all along.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he said there was a signal to Jupiter.
Oh, okay. All right, so then we're on to the Jupiter mission. And so this is, I think, the bulk of the movie.
Yeah.
We've got two characters. We've got Dave and Frank, and there are three other scientists who we never meet. They're in
cryo sleep.
Yeah, or like some sort of hibernation sleep. But they also, the sixth character, most interesting character in the movie by far, is the HAL 9000, also known as HAL.
Yeah.
He is an AI, artificial intelligence computer. Never, and they made a point in telling us that these computers have never made a mistake.
Yeah.
The 9000 series has never made any error.
Never an error. Well, and in Hal's mind, he didn't make an error because he thought he was doing the right thing.
But he goes bad. Hal goes bad.
But well, yeah, but he's trying to protect the mission.
I think we find out Hal never really turns bad, even though some people would claim that this is where AI goes bad. I think he put the mission ahead of the people, which may have been important, the most important thing. So I think he was just working within his programming. So I don't believe...
The mission would have ultimately failed without people because there would have been nobody to evolve into the Star Child.
That's true, but they didn't know that.
Yeah, so Hal had insufficient knowledge.
Yeah. So I think that it's not like a Skynet situation where the AI gets some sort of consciousness and decides it wants to take over. It's basically just, it's still running within the parameters of its original programming.
You know what the lesson is here, Matt?
What?
When we do eventually build AI and we send it on missions, we need to make sure that one of the mission objectives is keep the humans alive.
Yes.
Because, like, if they had done that,
yes,
would have been way better for them.
Absolutely. So it looked like Dave was just stuck in the shuttle. And there's a funny line from our live blog.
Yeah, Mike Poteet, I believe, said that this was his favorite part. Now I just got to find it again.
Yeah, so basically, as a setup.
You say.
Hal won't let Dave back into the main ship. He's in an outside shuttle.
Open the pod doors, Hal.
Yeah.
I can't do that, Dave. You say, I don't see where they're going to go from here. And I said, it does seem as though they've written themselves into a narrative corner. But, Matt, guess what? Hidden entrance.
Yeah, he breaks in. So Dave makes it back in, shuts down Hal, and that's when the video comes on. This is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Though I do like how, you know, we had to watch 5 minutes of Dave unscrewing disk drives from Hal first.
You were like, they're going to show us every screw that he has to unscrew, and they basically did.
Yeah, though as the scene went on, it won me over because it was like, you know, you see Hal slowly dying.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the thing. I don't need a movie that has quick cuts and is really flashy like a music video. So I can kind of appreciate an older style of film where it's taking its time, having long shots. So that's not my big complaint about this movie.
Right.
Just to, for the record. Yeah. I don't mind long shots. I do mind non-storytelling.
Yeah.
Which I think is what we got at the end.
Well, no, I think to me the ending actually tied everything together. I was satisfied with the ending once I clicked in my head.
But you don't know for sure that that's what the evolving means.
No, that'd be my theory. So now later I'll go and read other theories, and either I will be right or I will learn more from what other people have to say. I mean, that's the nice thing about watching a weird movie that's 50 years old is people have already figured it out. So it's not like walking out of Inception and you don't have any idea what happened.
Okay, so Dave shuts down Hal.
Yeah.
But he continues his mission to Jupiter. And so this is where I think everything falls apart for me.
This is where the movie went off the rails.
Totally crazy. So we see a monolith floating in space. Awesome. We get the title screen comes up that says Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. Okay, so all of a sudden, just it gets crazy. We start seeing things flashing through the sky. I'm kind of left with a feeling of, oh, this is kind of like a wormhole, possibly.
Yeah.
Let's see. Dave is just like in pain. And this scene is going on and on. They have weird color schemes when they're like showing landscape images. And they keep flashing to Dave's extreme close-up of Dave's eye. He's blinking. Yeah. It shows him his face. He's in pain. It shows these landscapes, mountains, rivers. But they're all like inverted colors and just it's a mess. It's
just a mess.
I mean, like trippy, like in the fullest sense of the word.
It was the 60s.
Yeah. And so it just goes, and this scene goes on and on. Just like when that guy in the yellow suit.
The Power Ranger.
Yeah. You know, not Dave, but Frank. He dies and he's flying through space after Hal kills him, basically. They just kept on going back to the scene of this poor astronaut just floating off into space.
Spinning.
Yeah, so it was like that. So it's on and on. And all of a sudden, it abruptly ends, and the shuttle is just in a bedroom. And we have no idea
pretty wild
how it's in a bedroom. And at that point, I was like, they are not going to explain this. We're just going to have to be okay with how this is weird. So then from the shuttle. And Dave has aged now at this point, I believe. Maybe not quite yet, but the next scene we see him looking at a guy in his red suit, his red space suit, and it's him.
Yeah, guess,
so he's looking upon himself, and then all of a sudden the shuttle's gone, and now he is just in the red suit. So now he's not looking at the person anymore, he is that person.
Yeah.
Then he hears a sound. No, maybe he's walking around the bedroom or the bathroom, and he hears a sound, and he looks out, and he sees another older version of himself eating.
And then he is him.
And then he is him, and then the red-suited person disappears. And then the eating version of him hears a sound coming from the bed, and he looks over, and there's an even older version of him probably dying in bed.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, he is the dying person, and the person that was eating is gone. And then the monolith appears in front of the bed.
That was wild.
Yep. And so and then all of a sudden the music starts and we're like, this movie's about to end, and we get a shot of not old Dave but a baby in a bubble,
which was just crazy.
Like a fetus, basically.
Yeah.
And so then the music starts up again, the grand music that opened the movie. So I said to Ben, it's gonna end.
Yeah,
it's and over. You're like, yeah, I think you're right.
And yeah, I was so like, it was the end.
I don't even care. I'm just glad that it's over because that was...
What the Frodo, I think.
What the Frodo.
Yeah.
And so And then somehow, even though they're at Jupiter, now all of a sudden we're at Earth, and the baby, is it a giant baby, is floating?
It looked like it.
Yeah, it looked planet-sized.
But maybe it was just like, it was closer to the
maybe
camera.
Maybe our perspective.
Right.
So it's either a giant baby, or just our perspective has this baby floating in a bubble in space next to Earth, and the movie ends. And if you've never seen this movie and that sounds stupid, you're right. It is stupid.
It was awesome. It's you know, artistic and brilliant. It makes you think about humanity and origins and destiny. And
what?
It does.
Okay, I did kind of start to get what was happening with the time travel. Like they kept flashing to different older versions of himself. But becoming a baby again.
That's the next stage of evolution.
Well, that's what
he's not a human, yeah.
Your take on it is that they've now, the monolith evolved Dave.
Yes.
I don't know if that's the real interpretation of this movie. Why don't you talk for a little bit? I'm going to do a little Wikipedia search.
Sounds like a plan, man. Well, I mean, I thought it was really well done. One of the things that was going through my head is, you mentioned like the quick cuts and all that we see today. Well, we also see like any time the aliens show up, they have to be big and dramatic, and you know, we have to have all this action stuff to keep teenagers' attention so the movie makes money. And this movie was content to just let the only really alien appearance, outside of maybe the Star Child at the end, it's just this monolith. And so I like the understated, subtle nature of the film. You know, I've become a Stanley Kubrick fan. I've only seen a handful of his movies, but I'm really, really enjoying what I've seen. And I love his style. And I thought that he did a great job really drawing you into this journey and helping you feel both the beauty and monotony of what space travel would be like.
Yeah.
Any results?
I mean, I found some stuff just kind of scanning through here. I guess it might be interesting to talk about the, you know, with novelization being written at the same time. Do you know any... I'm kind of interested to get your thoughts on that. What do you know about that situation?
I know that I believe that there was like a short story or something first, and then Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick kind of combined forces to expand it into a movie/novel. But I really like Arthur C. Clarke. Have you ever read any of his stuff?
No, I don't think I have.
Yeah, they're all kind of like this, you know, where it's not... They're fairly understated takes on science fiction. You're not going to get like giant space battles. So I think that knowing what was in store with an Arthur C. Clarke type project and knowing what was in store with a Stanley Kubrick project got me through the movie and helped me to appreciate it, where if I didn't appreciate those two going into it, I'm not sure I would have enjoyed it very much.
The screenplay is credited to Kubrick and Clarke, whereas the novel is credited in the reverse order, Clarke and Kubrick. Here's a quote from somebody in the know back in the 70s. There are a number of differences between the book and the movie. The novel, for example, attempts to explain things much more explicitly than the film does, which is inevitable in a verbal medium. The novel came about after we did a 130-page prose treatment of the film at the very outset. The initial treatment was subsequently changed in the screenplay, and the screenplay, in turn, was altered during the making of the film. But Arthur took all the existing material, plus an impression of some of the rushes, and wrote the novel. As a result, there's a difference between the novel and the film. I think that the divergence between the two works are interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait to read the novel. I have it on my Kindle, and I just haven't started it yet because I knew we were going to do the live blog.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty psyched for it. So do you think that does this inspire you to want to watch more Kubrick or read more Arthur C. Clarke?
Okay, I'll be honest. I am interested to see where this could go from here. So I know there's a 2010...
2061 and 3001. There are four books in the series.
But movie-wise, the next movie is 2010, The Year We Make Contact.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. I don't know if I want to watch it or if I just want to read what happens.
Right. I'll just spoil it for you, or you can Wikipedia it or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe we could have a follow-up episode where I ask you questions and you just tell me things.
There you go. Yeah, I'll read the whole series.
So I am interested to see where it goes from here, but not so interested that I think I want to take my own time to do it.
Yes.
I don't know. And so tell me again, it's 2010?
2010, 2061, and 3001.
I don't know, man. I kind of feel like you only like it because you feel like you have to like it.
No, I really enjoyed it. Like, legit enjoyment.
Here's something I could say positive about the movie.
Okay.
All the parts that there were dialogue.
Yeah.
Where there actually were people talking and there weren't extended, which this was common in case you haven't seen the movie, 2 to 5 or more minutes of shots, no talking. Not that I don't need nonstop banter, but I just feel like something should be happening if we're going to be, there was an intermission in this movie.
there's an intermission in Godfather 2.
Okay.
But that's a great movie.
Okay, so...
I say we, by the way, we need to bring back the intermission.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say we should do Godfather episode.
No, we should, though. That's not sci-fi.
About the trilogy.
I know.
So I think, though, dialogue-wise, that there were some interesting ideas in this movie. Yeah. So I think if there had been more story in here, because you admitted it after it was done, if they had taken out all of the random space shots.
That's true.
This movie would have been like an hour long.
Yeah.
Instead of 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a bad thing.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, I like the space shots. I mean, it wouldn't be the same movie without them. It draws you in a way that a few movies do. I mean, I don't want every movie to be like this, obviously, mm-hmm. but I like a movie that is, you know, able to do this with intelligence and with true artistic merit. I mean, I think that this is a very tough thing to pull off. Some people on the Facebook page.
Just to fill space in this episode, we'll have to read the listener feedback also.
Yeah, but they were comparing it to, like, Star Trek the Motion Picture. And, yeah, there's definitely commonalities in terms of aesthetic and movie-making philosophy. But the difference is that this is a well-told movie, where Star Trek the Motion Picture is just a mess. You know, it's a very lifeless, stilted experience, whereas 2001 is just so well done that it just feels brilliant.
It was good in some parts.
Yeah.
And in some parts it was not good. So I really like the writing of the, like, I guess I'm just restating what I said before. When people were talking and there was story being pushed forward by dialogue, I like that. But when the story was being pushed forward by interpretation, I don't think I like that as much. And I don't know. Is that me? I'm not trying to sound dumb and say I need somebody to explain things to me. But if there's not a more easily seen path that the movie maker is taking you on, it makes me feel like I'm going nowhere.
Right.
So I don't mind interpretation. For example, Inception, you get to interpret the end of that, but there's only so many ways you can go with it. But with this one, it's kind of like, what happened? Yeah. How? Like, just let me ask you, even if you think you know that the end means that humanity evolved, what happened between that end part? Like, how did Dave get there?
I think that you can, I mean, obviously he enters Jupiter's atmosphere and some trippy starts happening. I think you could maybe read it as he's having some kind of alien encounter, or it's a spiritual encounter, or he dies, or something like that. So I think there's a lot of different readings you could take on the ending that I'd have to think through a bit more. But I kind of like that. I like that there's a lot there that's open to interpretation.
Are the creators of the monolith God in this universe?
I sincerely doubt it, because Arthur C. Clarke, very, very much an atheist.
That would be pro this, Ben, because it would be kind of like a situation where you're saying there is no God. It's just aliens that...
Oh, I see what you're
like,
saying.
In this universe, are the creators of monoliths sort of godlike creatures?
Yeah, I'd say that. I don't think that within the narrative they'd be divine. I think Arthur C. Clarke's work is pretty adamantly atheistic.
We don't have to necessarily stop our conversation here, but should we take a break and do some listener feedback?
Take an intermission?
Yeah. Okay, I think you should load up your Facebook and we can just take turns, because for some reason, when I posted this question of the day this morning, what are your thoughts on Stanley Kubrick's classic film?
People went nuts with it.
There's so many responses, and some were...
Well, should we start with yesterday's, where I put up that we were going to live blog?
Yeah. I'll go scroll down there, and there's so much response. So it must be good.
Yeah.
It must be good.
So I wrote that we were going to live blog, and our first response was from Mickey, who said, "Don't look away from the screen too long. This movie is something like 80% visual, 15% musical, 5% story."
That's actually a good analysis now that I know what happened. So
yeah,
good.
But would you recommend not looking away from the screen?
No, I was tempted just to take a nap at one point. Like, I was like,
you were curling up next to me there.
I was like, Ben will wake me up when something starts happening again. All right, Ben Avery from the Strangers and Aliens podcast, which you can find at strangersandaliens.com, wrote about us live blogging. "Bad idea. This is a movie that requires attention. It's subtle, quiet, confusing, simple. It's very much a product of its time. Live blogging it, you lose the effect."
I disagree. I think
I would have never been able to make it through if we weren't joking about it the whole time.
I mean, I could have made it through, but I really enjoyed live blogging it. We are great live bloggers, and I feel like I got the effect. All right. You know, we're hilarious, but we're also enjoying the movie. It's not like we just turned it into a complete joke. I mean, it might give that impression from the live blog, but we were actually watching it, too.
Okay.
Right, so, incorrect, Mr. Avery. And then Paul Lewis writes, 2001 is a great movie. The book is very good as well. Did you know they were created simultaneously? Technically, it is not a book adaptation.
I'm glad he said that, because that,
that
allowed me to know that before we actually watch it. Yeah. So. All right, and then after I asked the question of the day with what people thought, we had a few jokes. I think this first one might be a joke. Mickey writes, in space, no one can hear you, Guitar Hero.
That's true.
I don't think I get that reference.
That's in space, no one can hear you scream.
Yeah, I know that, but what's the Guitar Hero reference?
I don't know.
Good one, Mickey.
But I did like how everything was silent in space in the movie. I thought that was well done.
That same thing Joss does in Firefly.
Yeah.
My friend Joss.
Yeah, your friend Joss. Bill writes, great visuals for its time. Arthur C. Clarke's source material was great. The soundtrack was great. The movie itself was just okay. It was very slow. Stick with the book.
Oh my gosh, I can't agree with the book part, but everything else? Well, because I haven't read it, but I think I agree with everything else he said. Yeah. Cristiano writes, masterpiece.
So you like the soundtrack?
I did. Yeah, I like classical music.
Yeah. Well, you get to read the next one, because you just got a one word.
Mickey says, I think the visuals look great still. But then I'm a little weird when it comes to special effects.
I agree with Mickey.
Realistic does not necessarily mean better in my book. The film has a daringly sparse narrative, which I appreciate. I disagree.
I agree.
It also features my favorite ever edited sequence in any film. The concept for the edit is simple and profound, and it's executed perfectly. Not a single frame too long or a single shot too short. I wish he had said which scene he's thinking of. Which
I think he's talking about the whole movie.
No, he says,
"Oh,
it features my favorite ever editing sequence." I wonder what sequence.
Probably the crazy trippy stuff at the end would be my guess.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, too.
Yeah. Paul writes, when people refer to a film as an art form, I always think of this movie. It's blown me away every time I see it. Me too, though I've only seen it once. From the silent way they begin setting up the mythology to the paranoia-inducing all-seeing red eye. I recently read the book. In fact, I read the entire series of books, and they are all really good, especially the first two. But this movie transcends. It is interesting to me the way the two of them worked out in real time, book and movie being written and filmed simultaneously. Kubrick and Clarke bouncing ideas off one another as each tells the same story in their own way. Do you think they also bounced off one another literally while writing this project?
I don't know. I doubt it.
I mean, they're both kind of odd fellows, so it would not surprise me.
Yeah, I'm not positive. Michael Poteet from the SciFiChristian.com writes, a beautiful meditation on humanity's place in the universe.
Ben Avery, it is a movie from a different era. The amazing visuals transcend the era, though. The narrative, what little there is, can easily be taken as pretentious or thoughtful. I believe it to be both, again, as a product of its time. It is very easy to write it off as boring or dumb, and people are used to and groomed by modern sensibilities, like Iron Man 3, Ben Avery?
I just want you to stop there for a second.
Okay.
We can come back to that. I'm for the record, I want to make sure I'm stating, don't think it's boring or dumb.
Exactly.
And I don't mind, he's right about the modern sensibilities, where people feel like it has to be fast-paced.
Yeah.
That's not what my problem with it.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, so nobody can write in and say, oh, Matt Anderson just needs nonstop action to like a movie. Because if you do, you're wrong. That's not what Matt is saying.
Thank you.
We'll have a hard time seeing it as otherwise, which is totally understandable. But if a viewer can let themselves go with the ride and try to understand the connective tissue between the four different segments and flow with the rhythm, it is an experience that you may not want to revisit, but that is still unmatched in cinema.
Interesting. Maybe, I could say, okay, Ben Avery and Ben DeBono, I'll say this. I don't want to revisit it, but I'm glad for the experience.
There you go.
All right. Ben Avery goes on to say, things to keep in mind. Odyssey is in its title for a reason. If this movie was made in the last 20 years, the events in the movie would possibly take 10 minutes. Dialogue is sparse. The movie is both mechanical, utilitarian in its approach, and very naturalistic. You're watching a movie that inspired almost every single sci-fi movie to follow. The movie itself is an epic in filmmaking, much the same way it covers epochs in man's history.
Indeed, indeed. Michael Poteet from the SciFiChristian.com. By the way, I'm also a fan of 2010, both book and film. I read 2061 and 3001, but didn't really get into either of those as much.
I really want to do a short follow-up episode after you've seen the other movies and read them, and then you can just kind of tell me what happened.
Okay.
Just so I can absorb the knowledge, but not actually do it myself.
Yes.
George has written into the Facebook and said this: as with other Kubrick films, the visual is foremost. For the time and possibly now, it was almost, well, for that time and possibly now, it was almost like a tour of space and less a film. That's, I can see that.
Yeah.
An excuse for an adult to let their mind run wild with imagination, something sadly missing in today's over-analytic world of dissecting entertainment.
Yes, indeed. And then Ben Avery has a comment that I don't understand. I really like 2010 too, very different type of film, and I can't tell if it's a sequel to 2001 or a prequel to Sequest.
Do you remember Sequest?
I have no idea what Sequest is.
It was a TV show syndicated in the 90s that I did not watch.
Yeah, that's probably for the best.
And
how many of these are we going to read?
All of them.
Really?
Why not?
Is that going to be good podcasting?
Well, we didn't read them ahead of time, so we don't know which ones are good.
Okay.
Michael Poti writes,
huh. We could just set this whole sequence to music and have it be like the movie.
This is us getting Kubrick back.
Yes, take that, Kubrick.
Take that, Kubrick. It's a more conventional film, yes, but I was right. Maybe I am getting tired of reading all these.
Yeah, maybe let's each choose one more.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. I don't mind doing a little editing. So what I'm going to do is I'll play a sound clip, and we'll take an intermission pause to find our favorite ones, and we'll come back.
Okay.
And we're back. Turns out that some of the comments ahead are a little spoilery.
Yeah.
So I asked Ben to stop reading. So
yeah, thank you, Matt.
Let's just stop the listener feedback. Do you want to do? Do you want to end it here? Or do you want to have any other thoughts?
No, I love the movie, but we can take her home.
Do you want to hear take that science that might apply?
Yeah, why not?
Because as I was getting ready for a news episode, which we're not going to have a full news episode this week. We're going to do a short news episode. But as I was preparing for
5 minutes.
Yeah, like if that.
Why don't we just release that news at the end of this one?
Like right now, have a news segment? No. I refuse to do that. That's a horrible idea.
Fair enough.
Okay. Here we go. Take that, science.
Take that, science. Take that, science.
Are dwarf lemurs the key to long-distance space travel?
I don't know. Are they?
Scientists have discovered that two tiny clawless tree-living lemur species hibernate underground for up to 6 months a year. Given the furry animals are primates, the findings have exciting implications for possible human hibernation.
Yeah.
From chipmunks to bats to even turtles, numerous wild species hibernate by slowing their metabolism, breath rate, and heart rate. These animals can put themselves into a state of suspended animation, allowing them to go without food or water for months on end.
That's a good point, because I always think, like, you know, how would this sort of cryosleep work?
Yeah.
But if animals are doing this all the time, why can't we do this? Come on, science!
Well, almost a decade ago, scientists learned that the fat-tailed dwarf lemur of western Madagascar hibernates. It's the first primate and the first tropical mammal discovered to do so. The new discovery may eventually help scientists figure out how to induce hibernation in people. And here's a quote from one of the scientists. There's a lot of research into that topic. Currently, and then she goes on to say, because the lemurs are primates, our biology is more similar to them than to squirrels. So hopefully we will be able to find similar genes and processes that help us hibernate. This article concludes by saying, the short-term goal is to figure out how to induce a safe state of hypothermia, mimicking the low body temperatures the eastern lemurs maintain in hibernation. This would help people stay in suspended conditions for a while.
Yeah.
And if scientists can isolate all of the components necessary for primate hibernation, we may be able to turn people into hibernators. Naturally, this has huge implications for long-distance space travel, when people would likely need to enter a dormant state to survive the long trips. So that's interesting, especially seeing that there were hibernators they used the word hibernation in this movie.
Yeah, so it's inexcusable that science hasn't figured this out. Take that, science!
Yeah.
Come on, science!
Come on, science. So, well, good talk, Ben.
That's good. Shake your hand?
Well, they can't hear it. Shake hand.
Oh, okay.
No, probably.
I do it more for us than I do for them.
I'm glad we saw the movie.
It was a great movie.
I don't think I'll watch it again, but I'm glad that we saw it.
Yeah.
Well, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I am Ben DiBono.
And we are the Sci-Fi Christians.
Signing off.
Signing off.
Let's watch it again.
No.
Monkey on Monkey.
There's lots of monkeys at the beginning, which I don't
know. There are.
I'll be honest with that. Why do you think they had to go 20 minutes? I mean, couldn't they have told that story in a short amount of time?
Yeah.
I know, it's just the effect. Nothing like monkeys.